When you think of the author William Least Heat Moon, you probably picture earth and country, rolling hills and tall prairie grass, small town diners and a truck called Ghost Dancing. So maybe it's surprising that his new book, a novel, is called Celestial Mechanics, and that the cover of this new book shows distant stars and outer space. Then again, now that he's spent decades writing about dirt and dust, country and county here on terra firma, maybe there was nowhere left to look but up. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, I'm honored to be speaking with William Least Heat Moon about his new book, but also his life, his ideas. In other words, we're giving him the portrait session treatment. Welcome to the show, William.
Well, thank you, Gina. I appreciate your interest in Celestial Mechanics, and it's good to be back in my home city, and I assume some people that I haven't seen for years are hearing my voice. So to anybody who recognizes that, hello.
Yeah, shouting out into the ether is always funny. Your big breakthrough book was Blue Highways, A Road Trip Across America, and it starts with a cautionary line, "Beware thoughts that come in the night." Could you read the opening couple of paragraphs of Blue Highways for us?
I will. "Beware thoughts that come in the night. They aren't turned properly. They come in askew, free of sense and restriction, deriving from the most remote of sources. Take the idea of February the 17th. That's almost today.
It is today. So weird.
What a coincidence. Okay, I'm ad-libbing there. A day of canceled expectations. The day I learned my job teaching English was finished because of declining enrollment at the college. The day I called my wife, from whom I've been separated 9 months, to give her the news. The day she let slip about her friend, Dick or Rick or Chick, something like that. That morning, before all the news started hitting the fan, Eddie Shortleaf, who worked a bottomland section of Missouri River and plowed snow off of campus sidewalks, told me if the deep cold didn't break soon, the trees would freeze straight through and explode. Indeed.
So that, from there, you kind of just took off in your truck and started talking to people all over the country. What was that like?
It was invigorating, certainly. I felt uncertain during much of it, and when I began the trip, 1978, when I began the trip, I wasn't certain that my idea of just wandering into small towns and cornfields, wherever, that I would get people to talk to me. But I began in the South because of the weather. I left on March 20th, the first day of spring, sleeping in the back end of a Ford van, which, by the way, is now on display in Columbia, Missouri, at the Museum Support Center. So if somebody's interested, you can go by and see Ghost Dancing.
I love that the van is on display.
It is. It is. You need to make a phone call, but it's the Museum Support Center.
Do you ever go visit the van?
I do, but I have to be careful. If I pop into that driver's seat again and put my hands on the wheel, I can feel my eyes getting damp. It's almost too much.
What is it that's evoking that emotional response?
I would guess the first thing that's there is the sense of time's lost, time's gone, and the people whom I knew at that time, not just connected with Blue Highways, but with all parts of my life, that so many of them are gone. But the other part is that what an exciting thing it was. You ask how I felt then.
Yeah.
It was exciting. I remember waking up in the van. I had a little bunk in the back. And waking up in the morning and getting ready to take to the highway again. And this happened for almost 3 months. I can't believe I'm really doing this. And as the trip went on, I could add to that. I can't believe that it's working, that I can just walk into these places and people will start talking. Sharing their lives. I was going to say earlier about the beginning, it's good because of the cold weather I went south first, because conversations are so easy to start there. If I'd gone to Minnesota, to pick a state north, it would have been more of a challenge.
You think so? I mean, was your experience that people really were more reticent in colder climates?
Yes. they're polite, and sometimes that politeness, I think, for a stranger walking in to find a conversation can be difficult. They don't want to interfere with you. They don't want to say anything that would disturb you. So you have to talk longer to get to something. But in the South, anything can be up front immediately. You'd be talking to somebody for 60 seconds, and you may be hearing about their divorce. You may be hearing about a mother-in-law, the job.
This book spent 42 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Did that surprise you?
It did indeed. I think when beginning writers start out, and certainly I was a beginning writer, entirely innocent of what was going on, I think we have dreams of a book reaching an audience, but that, for it to happen that quickly and that broadly was surprising. And it's not really happened that way again. Blue Highways happened to be right for its time.
A lightning strikes once kind of thing?
It could be, yes. Yeah. Oh, and the publishing business has changed so much. The reading public has changed. I don't know what your valued listeners here think about that phrase of the dumbing down of America. I happen to think there's something to it. And my books do require that the reader pay attention at least and maybe also participate just a bit in the reading, especially true of Prairie Earth, the book about the Kansas Prairie. Readers need to be participating there to put things together. And some people just don't want to do that, especially males.
Huh. So you have a sense of who your demographic is, it sounds like.
I do now. I didn't in the beginning, of course, but I do now. I've heard from so many of them for, 30 years with letters and now with digital, primarily Facebook. I really have a sense of what they like, what they don't like.
What do people like?
I think the one thing I hear about most commonly is and I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm just saying this is what I hear from them. They comment on the language of my books.
How would you describe the language of your books?
Oh, I don't want to sound like a politician, a blowhard here, but maybe the word would be rich, and at times a little complex.
But here's my take. I guess I think you are not afraid to pepper your writing with what I might call like vocabulary words. I mean, words that people are unlikely to have learned just in casual conversation, but maybe on flashcards or while reading, that's where these words are likely to come from, a lot of them. But then those alternate with really starkly simple sentences and straightforward language, too. I mean, I wish that I had written down the exact sentence, but there's a character you meet in Prairie Earth, and we'll get back to that book, but his name is Slim, and you introduce him by saying his name was Slim. And he wasn't.
That's true, yes. I hear about my vocabulary frequently, many times. And you ask me the question about what do I hear from the readers. That would be very close to the top of the list. Most of the time now, people are happy with it. But there is somewhat of a gender breakdown. Women are more likely to be accepting of words that they don't know, more likely to make a list of them. Men are more likely to get annoyed and at maybe quit reading the book. Being a male, I can say that I think this is their ego working there, and they don't want anybody to appear smarter than they are. I'm not saying I'm smarter than they are, but by no means. But I do know some words they may not know, and that will put some of them off. But I think that the language is to be used to its fullest, and that's why, as you mentioned, that the range of words can be from slang on up to something that you might have to go to the Oxford English Dictionary to find. Not many of those, but occasionally.
Yeah, I want to get back to Blue Highways just a little bit, and then we'll move on. But one of my friends called Blue Highways a game changer, and I'm guessing it was that for you, too, in your life.
It was indeed. I can't imagine what my life would have been like without Blue Highways. The trip began, readers may remember this, those who've seen it, I was out of a job. I'd been teaching at Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri. I'd lost my job because of declining enrollment. I was out in a marriage that was in serious collapse, free fall. And I was also 38 years old. I had 4 degrees from the University of Missouri, and I was without a job, and I couldn't find one. I couldn't get a teaching job. That's when the teaching market, especially in English, collapsed. Blue Highways, I really kind of took to the road in desperation. What else can I do now? And it was to fill a dream. I mean, we're Americans. We're all descendants of people who came from the other side of the earth, from the Eastern Hemisphere, all of us.
People who believe we can start all over.
Yes, yeah, we're the descendants of people who said, I don't like my life here. I'm going to cross the Pacific or the Atlantic and start again. So it's natural for us to, when our lives don't go quite the way that we want, you know, the thought is, well, I'm going to put my kit bag over my shoulder and hit the road in one way or the other. So that's what I did. And it took 4 years to write Blue Highways, but that certainly reset my life. And strangely, and we could talk about this when it comes up, but with this new book, the novel, Celestial Mechanics, this book changed me in a very different way, but I think probably as deeply. And my publisher, Three Rooms Press in New York City, calls the book Blue Highways of the Mind.
Huh.
It is an exploration. It is a kind of wandering, but in a very different way from Blue Highways.
Through an internal landscape, maybe?
Very much so, but also through a kind of, if I can use the word, cosmic landscape. My lead character is an amateur astronomer, so there's a great deal of the celestial in the book.
Well, yeah, we are going to get pretty deeply into that book later in the conversation, but I want to make sure that all of our listeners, especially those who maybe haven't read the books that really made you famous, know kind of where you're coming from and, for lack of a better phrase, why you're a really big deal. The other book that you're famous for, famous, if you don't mind my saying so, in maybe a slightly nerdy way, is Prairie Earth, PRAIRYERTH. And it's a book that combines a lot of different formats, I would say. I mean, you've got quotes about the prairie mixed in with your own observations of the prairie, histories, stories from people who populated Chase County, that's in the Flint Hills. What gave you the idea for that book?
I think it began on the Blue Highways trip, in which I would go into a place that was new to me, unfamiliar to me, and spend some time there. And not all of them, but many of them, I would get interested. And I really didn't want to leave, but I knew that the trip was the thing. I had to keep moving. I wasn't going to lock down into one place. So I began thinking about travel, horizontal travel, which is what I was doing in Blue Highways, moving pretty quickly around the states, many of the states. But I thought there's also another way to travel, and that is a deep travel, where one goes into one small limited area and stays there and tries to travel not just across that small area, the topographic area, but also its history, to move through time. And I thought, because I'd been interested in the Flint Hills of Kansas for so long, I thought, I think I'll go over and look in the Flint Hills of Kansas and see what I can find. And I came across, traveled into Chase County and the Tallgrass Prairie, and it just looked right. It really spoke to me.
What do you think it was about it that spoke to you?
The first thing that caught my eye was the prairie landscape itself in the Flint Hills. If one drives from one coast, East Coast, West Coast, through the middle of America, I have to say driving from the East Coast, and you drive west, when you hit Chase County, if you're right in one of our great central highways, say Highway 50, US 50, when you enter Chase County, that's the place where you will first say, my gosh, we're in the west now. It no longer feels like the east. It's really very, very stark and abrupt. There's just no question. It's almost like a line across, a vertical line, a meridian running through there. It says this is east, this is west. Second thing was the limestone of the hills, which they use so beautifully there to build buildings where they used to. The limestone architecture really caught my attention.
This idea of going deep, I mean, you call Prairie Earth a deep map. That's an interesting phrase, like just the idea that a book can be really essentially a map. I mean, I guess I think of maps as places are designated just, you know, by a line or a dot. And the idea of a deep map to me, I don't know if I've got this right or not, but it's just that within that dot, within any single dot on a map, there are human beings and stories and plant life and nature and crazy weather events, especially in the Midwest. And just the idea that you're going down into that dot. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. People, not everybody, but many people who are not familiar with the prairie, this is true of mountainous people or people maybe from the east, the forests, get into Chase County, get into the prairie states, the Tallgrass Prairie, the Short Prairie, and they are likely to say, well, there's nothing here. They're not seeing a lot of trees, and the landscape is so open. So that was one of the attractions also to write about, in this case, Chase County. I wanted to show how much was really there, even though it looks like there's not much there. You can see so much in distance, but to see anything probably really significant, you need to get up close and look more deeply, if you will.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, Prairie Earth was sort of groundbreaking, in part because it treated this place that most people thought of as just nothingness with that kind of respect, and it filled the void with so much detail. Do you think that in some way you reframed the conversation about the Midwest?
Well, I don't know that I should try to take so much credit, but I can say this, Gina, that I was fortunate after Blue Highways to have a really fine editor, a poet, Peter Davison, worked out of Boston. And he was a man who, even though he was not a Kansan, was not really familiar with the prairie, but he liked the book, put it that way. Prairie Earth, if it had come first before Blue Highways, would never have been published or been taken years to get published. Blue Highways opened it up. But it was Peter Davison that said, I think we can make this book go. And the book's not been out of print in 25 years. And, you know, let's be honest about it. This is a book about Kansas. And that, as a woman said to me not too long ago, I know three things about Kansas. It's flat, it's treeless, and it takes two pages up in the Rand McNally Road Atlas. Well, the last one is true, but otherwise those other statements aren't true. But that's a perception that so many Americans have. And so if they read Prairie Earth, they see that if Prairie Earth is as rich in its history, both geologic history and its geologic past, I should say, and human history, then their landscape must also be that rich, no matter where they live. And so there have been people who have started approaching their own territory with this idea of a deep map. And I think it helps link us as Americans. It doesn't have to be Americans, it can be anywhere in the world, link you with something very large, which is the land we live on. And that's where Celestial Mechanics, the new book, takes off and goes beyond that.
A national reporter recently stopped by our newsroom as part of a project to get to know this part of the country, something I think a lot of national news outlets are doing right now because people kind of feel like they missed something about how we live and think here in the dusty Midwest, you know, in their coverage leading up to the election. And this reporter said she'd been reading about the Midwest before coming here, and Prairie Earth was one of her reference materials. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm pleased, of course, honored, perhaps. And I think it will present a picture that many other of the books about the Middle West overlook.
What do you think people overlook?
I'm sorry, think what?
What do you think people do overlook about this part of the country?
Oh, it's richness. They're unfamiliar with the character of our people here. When I travel away from the Middle West for a while and come back, I'm struck again at how friendly people are. And that's particularly true in Kansas City. You know, I live in Columbia now. But coming over here yesterday, I was just struck with how easy it is to get things done here talking with people. It's easy in Columbia, too. Not so easy, say, if you're in New Jersey. Not so easy, perhaps, in some ways, if you're in California. But here, people are there.
You know, you wrote then about the depopulation of Chase County, and one town you visited had a population of 5 at that time. I mean, the depopulation of Kansas has continued, and I wonder what you think about sort of, I don't know, what's happened in Chase County since you wrote Prairie Earth?
Well, that town is you can see the signs of it. It's pretty well gone, and you can drive across western Kansas and see this even more, obviously, where the towns are dying. It's across the so much of the country, rural America. But in the case of Prairie Earth, it gave a big boost to the establishment of the Tallgrass Prairie National Park, which is there now. Nancy Kassebaum, she was a senator from Kansas a few years ago, and she came up and she was a supporter of the park. Bob Dole, the other senator from Kansas, was opposed to it. I don't know why, but he was.
It's just it's a place where you can go on a really long hike through the prairie, or you can go into an old structure. I believe it was once a family home, maybe. That park is really just...
Oh, the park itself, yes. Sam Wood home is there. But Nancy Kassebaum came up and thanked me for being the tipping point, Prairie Earth being the tipping point in getting the Tallgrass Prairie through Congress and established. That wouldn't happen now, but it happened then in the 80s. So the result was is that Chase County has had a nice economic uplift, maybe not enough, they're all that they want, but it's better than it was. And the county seat, right there close to the park, Cottonwood Falls, has a functioning hotel. Now, one of the nicest hotels in Kansas, right there on Broadway, the main drag. The main drag is only 3 blocks long.
So, yeah, they've had a little bit of a tourist boost.
Absolutely.
What do you think about the relevance of the themes in Blue Highways? Do you see those taking on a new kind of life today?
Well, certainly the idea of traveling and getting to know our land is there. There are other things that I thought were starting to change and take off, and the big one that comes to my mind is that traveling across the country, particularly through the South. And I should say here, I've been in every county in America, the 3,170 counties. I've been in every one, so I have a feeling for the country, I believe. And I really thought we were making progress on getting along with one another, the racial aspect. But we know what's happened here in the last few years, that I apparently not made as much progress as we need to. We have made progress. I feel very strongly about that.
William Least Heat Moon, stay with me through the break, okay?
I'll be here.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear about this Missouri author's personal journey, which begins right here in Kansas City, and then later on we'll be getting to his new book and your questions. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a portrait session with William Least Heat Moon. He's one of the most acclaimed travel writers of our time, but while his first book took him across the country, his other big hit took him deep into one county in the Flint Hills of Kansas for 622 pages. Now he's got a new novel. It's called Celestial Mechanics. Hi again.
Hi, Gina. Happy to be here.
You grew up in South Kansas City. Whereabouts?
Right between Troost and Paseo on near 74th Street. One of the things I remember so fondly is on one side, on Paseo, we had a streetcar that ran from the far south end of the city, from the city limits, on downtown. And on the other side, on Troost, right here where we're sitting today, we had a fine bus service. And there's another streetcar on over called the Country Club Line that ran up along Ward Parkway. It was just, you could travel all over the city on a streetcar. And I tell you, for a boy who was had some kind of a special feeling for movement and travel, those streetcars were just marvelous. There's so many miles that you could do.
We have a little stretch of new streetcar. Have you gotten to explore that?
I have not been on it yet. I've seen it, and I'm very happy to see Kansas City is progressing in that way, because so many cities now are trying to return to the wonderful, wonderful thing called a streetcar.
Tell me a little bit more about the Kansas City you remember from your childhood.
The first thing that comes to mind, this is free association, is the Country Club Dairy on Troost. I guess I'm thinking of that because Troost is right outside here. Throughout the city, you couldn't go too many blocks if you're on a main business street without encountering so-called drugstore. And every drugstore then had a soda fountain in it, and soda meant CO2, carbonated water. It did not mean what I grew up calling pop, my wife calls soda, She's from St. Louis. This was genuine CO2, and there would be a range of syrups back there, maybe 10 or 12 of them. And I remember one drink called, when some places it was called an all-around, another place it was called a cross-country. And the soda jerk, they were almost all males wearing white caps and white shirts, would take a squirt of each of these syrups, strawberry, chocolate, you name it, just a squirt, and then mix in the CO2 under pressure, made it quite a hissing sound. And you could tell him, I want it heavy on the CO2. No, easy on the carbonated water. You could actually mix something together. Then that great thing called an ice cream soda. I see those occasionally at, say, a DQ or something, but it's nothing like what we had then. And the Country Club Dairy, I mean, that's where the milk was processed, and you went down. It smelled like a dairy in there, and their ice cream sodas and their malted milks. Then those you can occasionally see malt mentioned in a eatery today, but it doesn't have malt in it anymore, as far as I know. But the real thing, the malt, in the drugstores came out of a little container and be squirted in there. It has a distinct and I think a wonderful taste. So you could tell a malted milk from a milkshake. Not the same thing. Today, as far as I can tell, if somebody offers a malt, it's a milkshake.
I love that this is your answer to the question about the Kansas City of your childhood. You know, do I understand correctly that you had a neighbor who you kind of visited different parts of the city with?
Yes, our next door neighbor, we lived on Flora, 74th and Flora. He was a native of Kansas City. He was a musician, and he loved to eat. He was Jewish, but he built his own barbecue, and he didn't do much pork. Kansas City, as we all know, is not really a pork town. That's St. Louis. We're a beef town. Occasionally, he would do the pork. He didn't follow any dietary restrictions, but he would put in a big rack of beef ribs on this brick barbecue oven that he built himself in the backyard. It's still there, by the way. I've never had better ribs. I mean, he could compete with what we call the thin Charlie Bryant's. It's Bryant's today, but Charlie Bryant's in those days. He could compete with them. It was so good. But he would take my father into places that my dad otherwise probably would not have discovered. I remember, for example, there were a couple of really nice, true, genuine Mexican restaurants down near the tracks where the railroads were, and there were a lot of Mexican workers who worked on the tracks there, so that they had to eat. You'd go in there, and they would eat Mexican food. Tastes nothing or very little like what we get today. This is the real thing. And he would go into the black part of the city and find other places there, other barbecue spots to eat. So then my father would take me to those places, and I'm sure that influence had a great deal to do with Blue Highways and where I was and all the talk that I put into Blue Highways about food.
Just the idea that that's a way to meet people who just don't live where you live.
Well, certainly the meeting, that's a good place to do it. But also just when I'm on the road, I get hungry. And so let's time to eat. Get out, and in that case, the Blue Highways trip, you know, get out of the van and go in and see what happens. And the so-called, we use the phrase mom and pop now. I don't remember you hearing that in the early days, but the mom and pop places, they're really getting fewer and fewer. So much food now is box food. It's boxed up and it's preheated. It's assembled. It's not cooked. It's assembled. And that's one of the real casualties, I think, of traveling America, is that you really got to look harder now to find something that's worth your time.
Other than this neighbor, who had a big influence on you at this time? I mean, relatives or other just people you encountered?
No, in the terms of relatives, it would have been my father, who liked to speaking now of the late 40s and the early 50s, who liked to get in the car and take one of the federal highways that come through Kansas City, 50, 71, 40, and take that high on his vacation. He had 2 weeks. He's a lawyer. And follow that highway to its conclusion. So we'd get on 40 or 50, and we'd drive until we hit the Atlantic Ocean, turn the other way on those highways, hit the Pacific. Or in terms of 71, we'd go up to International Falls on the Canadian border, head 71 down into Louisiana.
Did you have a relative who was also a doctor?
My grandfather was a physician, yes. Yeah, he worked in over around the Santa Fe tracks. He was in the Spanish-American War and spoke a little Spanish, so he had a nice patient clinic there with the Mexican track workers.
Talk to me about the Kansas City that maybe he exposed you to. Or did he?
No, he did not really. I was five when he died.
Oh.
Well, I sure would have loved to have talked to him about the Spanish-American War, though.
Tell your name on your birth certificate is not William Least Heat Moon. Where did that name come from?
Let me make this as short as I can. I almost regret using it as a pen name because I have to explain it so often. My father is Heat Moon. Our last full-blood Osage ancestor, as far as we can track, the records are very poor, was born in July, the Moon of Heat. And when my father was inducted into the Tribe of Miccosay, a scouting organization, he was a scoutmaster, he took the name Heat Moon. When my elder brother came along, he became Little Heat Moon, being initiated into the tribe. He had to go on a vision quest. And when I came along, I'm 7 years younger, I could have taken any name that wasn't taken, but I wanted to stay in the family line, so that meant that little is taken, that left Least Heat Moon. That's the way it went. So I took that. I had no idea then that it would become a pen name, and it's given me funny stories and a lot of occasionally some tangles of trying to have let Americans know that this is a real name. Where do you put the first? There was no hyphen in it, so people were calling me Moon. Well, that's half a name. It's Heat Moon. It's not Moon. The hyphen goes between the Least and the Heat, so they think it's my first name. And that pen name is Least Heat. No, that's not it. It's Heat Moon. So I would, if I'd known what I was getting into, I might have done it differently.
You know, I'm curious about. I feel like I've heard so much about where your love of travel and motion comes from, but I'm not sure if I've heard where your love of literature or writing or language, where those things come from.
I think they came with the genes, genetic, not Levi's. I wasn't born with a book in my hand, but soon as I could hold one, I was holding one. Today I have a library at home. It's about 17,000 books in there. And I give a lot away each year to the library sales in Columbia. I buy more than I keep.
Well, we've got a little more time for our conversation with William Least Heat Moon this morning on KCUR Central Standard. After the break, we'll hear about his new novel, and we'll take your calls if you're a fan who's always wanted to tell him how his writing has shaped your life, or if you have a question about a character or a book. Now's your chance. 816-235-2888. This is a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking to the writer William Least Heat Moon about his life and his books. Later on, we'll have it all online for you to share, along with photographic portraits by Paul Andrews. Now, if you have a question for William Least Heat Moon or a story about how his writing has affected your life, now's your chance to call 816-235-2888. Welcome back, William.
Glad to be back.
So your new book is called Celestial Mechanics, and the title refers to a branch of astronomy and applied math. You start the book with a quote from Isaac Newton's Principia. This is the quote, "Two particles of matter attract each other with a force proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them." Can you translate that into something we might understand?
You just kill sales probably by 95%. Well, it's a metaphor. The idea, it's among other things, metaphor. The idea is it's a love story. It's a ghostly love story. And the idea is that there are several loves in there. Some attract, have a kind of gravitational attraction to each other. Others repel. As we know, magnets will do. So it becomes a metaphor in that way and in other ways, but that's the central one. Celestial mechanics is the scientific study of how the stars and the planets hang in the sky, so to speak, how they move. And I see the characters in there as planetary.
There are two main characters, Dee Dee and Silas. Who are they? And if you don't mind my asking, what do they represent to you?
I'm going to answer that cautiously, because if I say the book has a great deal of suspense in it.
Okay.
And if I say too much, I'm going to kill some things. But the central character is Silas Fortunato. That last name works in the story to talk about fortune and destiny, but it also is the name of a friend of mine here in the city who used to work at the Kansas City Public Library, Henry Fortunato. I thought that's a perfect name for a character. He's an amateur astronomer, as I said, and he's a single man, young.
And he wears too much brown for his age, you say.
That's true, yeah. A young man should not wear too much brown. Wear something brighter. Good memory on that. But he's trying to figure out how he fits in with forgive the term, but it's the one to use, and with the cosmos, with all that exists. And he's struggling to make fit in his who he is with the women that he meets, and I don't want to say too much about the women because they're so important in developing the story, and I'm going to ruin some things if I do. So if you let me off of that part,
okay.
But there are three women there who play a major part, equal part with Silas.
You know, I was wondering, as I was reading, these are really young characters who are part of a different generation than you were. And I was curious whether part of what you're writing about has to do with your observations of generations coming up now.
Oh, yes. And I think the ideas behind the book are very much pointed toward people younger than I am. I'm 77, pointed to people that are at least a generation younger, maybe two. I think part of what's going on in this country today and around the world is that so many people, young and old, no longer have never felt a connection with something that's really greater than they are. And that's what Silas is attempting to do, to find a link that ties him with if you will, with the stars. I mean, we are skin around star matter. We are stardust.
Silas has a particular outlook on technology, and I kind of want to talk to you about that a little bit. This is a quote. He considered spurious the implicit message in a digital linkage: you are not alone.
Well, I think it's one of the great attractions to, let's say, a smartphone, any kind of phone, to people, is that I see people walking down the street. We all see these people, and I'm sure I'm speaking to many of them right now. They're clicking away on the phone, looking at the screen, oblivious to what's around them. I think that if I had had a cell phone in 1978 when I took the Blue Highway trip, if I'd traveled around, I hope not too much while I was driving. I don't do that at all. I don't have a cell phone. But walking through some of these villages with a phone in front of my face, I would have come home after 3 months. I would have had no stories to tell. I would have been living in that digital, virtual, key word there, virtual world, not in the world that I was actually in. So I think now that when I see people buried in this virtual world, they're not building any kind of memories that are going to be with them when they get older. And I tell you, when you get older, one of the great things that helps is having a good memory bank. And I think that's one of the reasons that so many people fear, justly so, Alzheimer's, is that the memory goes, and that's where you live most of your life.
Oh, yeah, the idea that it's sort of, I guess, you know, it's funny that the idea in that quote I read was that you turn to this digital world because you don't want to be alone, but then without the memories that you forge when your phone is off, there's something lonely about not having the memories that you would have created.
Well, I think so, yes.
You know, I'm wondering if you see this book as a departure from your previous work, in that it's a novel, which your previous work is nonfiction, and it refers in its big metaphor to space instead of an earthly kind of geography. Do you think that you're picking up where your previous books left off, or do you think it's a departure?
Well, it's both, but mainly I see it as a fulfillment of my other books, especially Blue Highways. And I think my publisher in New York, Three Rooms Press, I think they're very smart in calling it The Blue Highways of the Mind. It's an attempt to bring things together, and that's what Silas is attempting to do, not only in his love life, but in his philosophical life too. How do I fit in? What's the point? Does my life have any meaning beyond me?
What do you think about my theory that you didn't have any place left to look but up?
Well, I like it. I think it's funny, but I don't agree with it. I spent 8 years in one prairie in Kansas, in Chase County, 8 years in there working on prairie earth. So I know how deep things are. But what I also realize is that I did not, when I was younger, did not spend enough time looking up. I say in the book, Silas, the character, says that everybody should be able to identify in the sky, point out in the sky, at least two planets by name, say a few things about them, and also six stars, not constellations, stars.
I definitely fail this test, although I can name the sun.
Well, that's a star, so you qualify. But beyond the sun, six stars. I mean, Sirius, this is a good time of year to see Sirius. The star, it's our nearest star, it's our brightest star, and it's fairly near. It's about less than eight light years away, which means that light from that star that you are looking at left that planet 8 years ago.
Let's hear from some of our callers who are, I think, fans of yours and want to say a few things to you. Let's hear first from Jesse in Oak Grove. Hi, Jesse.
Stand by one.
Jesse, are you there? Oh, okay. Jesse is no longer there, so we will talk instead with Mike in Westwood. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. This is an unabashed fan call. I just wanted to commend the author for his work, and one that I particularly enjoyed was An Osage Journey to Europe, which I don't think enough people have heard about.
No, you're the first person in several years to mention that book. It's published by the University of Oklahoma. Mike, what is your last name? Do I know you?
No, we haven't met.
Oh.
My last name is Shields, but
okay.
I've read several of your books, but that one is one that I thought it'd be good to get the name out for
well,
people.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's about a trip that six Osages from down in southwest Missouri, southeast Kansas, made to Europe in 1827, and how the Europeans responded to seeing the Osages. The Osages were known as giants of the prairie, and even today, if you go down to the Osage Reservation in Oklahoma, you'll see a lot of people who are well over 6 feet. So the Europeans were stunned.
Okay, let's talk with Mike in Overland Park. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Oh, I got right in. Yes, I was. I've read and reread Blue Highway several times, and I hope I have this memory correct. You were talking about Alzheimer's. Hopefully, I don't have that. But anyway, there's a place called Swampback Guineas, I believe the name of the restaurant is. And I always thought, is this place for real? I mean, I've read this several times, and I just tried looking it up online, and I can't either on misspelling.
No, well, you're right, Mike. The Swamp Guineas in Georgia. It's a real place, and the last time I heard from somebody fairly recently, who had been there, said, yes, it's still there. It's bigger now. And apparently it got quite a boost from Blue Highways. But the description of it is an accurate thing. It's a real place.
Can you just very quickly tell us what it is for those who didn't read the book?
Well, it's a down-home restaurant at which served with the meal. It's fish and chicken and so on, the kind of things you would expect in the South. You get a full loaf of bread with every meal, full loaf of white bread.
Full loaf of white bread.
Yes, that's the only time I've ever seen that.
So we're hearing from so many of your fans of your previous works, and I know that you're really eager to talk today about your new novel. And what is it that made you, we've talked about going from looking down at the earth to looking up at the sky, but what about going from nonfiction to fiction? What was that like for you?
It really wasn't that different, partly because in my nonfiction, those eight books, I'm using fictional techniques many times. It's especially true in Roads to Quaz and to River Horse, less so in Prairie Earth, but also in Blue High was very true, using fictional techniques of presenting dialogue and people and so on. That's nonfiction, but I'm just using other techniques. Coming to the novel, I'm using the fictional techniques again, but I'm also using a great deal of nonfiction. There is so much in Celestial Mechanics that I have not made up. The characters, they're based upon people I know, often composites. Many of the events in there happened. I didn't make those things up. There's one story in there about a girl in a parochial school who her name's Dee Dee, you mentioned earlier, who's a challenge as a pupil and challenges the nun teacher. And the nun gets upset, and because the girl breaks her pencil two or three times and taking an arithmetic test so she doesn't have to take it, the nun takes her to the pencil sharpener and puts her finger in there and says, "Shall I turn this, or are you going to take the test?" I didn't make that story up. That's an actual story out of St. Louis.
This book, another theme that it kind of picks up on, even just in how the book starts, really, is travel. I mean, the very opening scene has two characters meeting in a sort of tucked away little hotel, kind of in the middle of quote unquote nowhere, you know, on a blustery night. Talk to me about how your early travels live in your mind, because it feels to me, I don't know, like this is territory you've trod. You know what I mean?
Well, the incident you're talking about, the opening chapter, is another thing. I didn't make it up. You can go see that hotel in Columbia, Missouri. It's the Tiger Hotel. Been there since 1927, I think. It's only four pages in the book, but I describe it. And the history that appears in the book of the hotel, which is to explain how a hotel goes from being heated with coal to one that's now heated with oil and electricity. That's all just facts that came out, and that's what I try to do. When I'm setting scenes in Celestial Mechanics, I'm thinking of other places I've been, as well as other people whom I've talked with.
Let's hear from another caller. We've got Bonnie on the line in Fairway, and speaking of travel, I think she wants to talk to you about that. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I'm another big fan who read your book back when it was first published, and it changed our lives. My late husband and I just got off the state highways, and we went in and explored so many wonderful places. And I've told so many friends over the years about Blue Highways and how it can enrich their lives. So thank you.
Well, Bonnie, I appreciate that. I should say here that when Blue Highways came out, the interstates weren't even quite completed then across the country. The interstate system has drastically changed the way that we see the country. We can see a lot more miles, but in many ways we see a lot less of the people who are along those miles. And that was the idea behind the book Blue Highways, to stop, get out from behind the windshield and see what people are like. I think today we've been through a really rough political season, and I think so many of these politicians are getting up there and gassing on about this and gassing on about that. I yell at the TV screen every so often, you know, get out and talk with the people so you know what you're talking about. And they fake that, but it's fakery.
Bonnie talks about traveling with her husband, and as someone who has just written a novel about what draws not just celestial bodies together, but what draws human beings together, I'm interested in the difference between travel with another person and travel alone. You've written books from both vantage points.
Oh, yes. Yeah, good question. Well, Blue Highways is the lone traveler. I was inspired when I was in the Navy. John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie came out. I don't think it's his best book by any means.
It's no Grapes of Wrath?
Grapes of Wrath is much better. And it's also a road book, yeah. Better, much better road book. But Travels with Charlie has a charm to it, and it certainly influenced me. I was trapped on this aircraft carrier in the Atlantic Ocean so many times, and it was one of my escapes to read that. And I said, one of these days when I get out of this Navy, I'm gonna hit the road the way Steinbeck did. Steinbeck was in his 60s when he took that trip. And when my life turned rough, Steinbeck was coming out of cancer treatment. I did the same thing, hit the road.
And it was important that you did that alone?
Absolutely. He took a dog, and that dog, Charlie, I think really harms the book. He spends too much time talking about the dog rather than talking about somebody he met along the road.
William Least Heat Moon, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a delight to be here and to be back in my home city for a few days.
William Least Heat Moon's new book is Celestial Mechanics, A Tale for a Midwinter Night, and that's from Three Rooms Press. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today if you missed any part of it or want to send it along to a friend. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And this is a portrait session, which means that the conversation will be paired with photographic portraits by Paul Andrews. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City, and Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is coming right up. Nancy Kassenbaum, who came up during the show, will actually be a guest on Up to Date, so stick around for that next.